It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, wearing it on your sleeve. Why fashion matters. So, Jackie, I have to ask, what are you wearing?
I am wearing a black boiled wool Cossack coat from the 1950s. It has a capelet. And this piece was actually a gift to me from my colleague, my NPR colleague, Renee Montaigne.
You might recognize that voice. It's Jackie Leiden, longtime foreign correspondent and host on NPR. But lately, she's switched from covering distant wars to creating her own startup, an independent podcast about fashion. It's called The Seams. Some of the segments have already aired on NPR. So, Jackie, why create a whole new program about fashion?
Well, I had to do something. So there was that. There was that little bit of impetus. But we had actually started The Seams last year. And here, Anne, is the biggest reason. I felt that in my years as a journalist here, I remember saying to one of my young colleagues, what do I do next? Because I had hosted a lot of shows. I'd done a jillion stories. And my young colleague said, Jackie, you should cover fashion. And I said, yes, but not hemlines and trends and seasons. Vogue can do that and does it really well, along with many other outlets. What we need to do is connect the anthropology of fashion to public radio audiences, to basically people who had questions that involve historical context or the significance or the memory of clothing. This tiny rural workshop represents one thread of a supply chain that loops from Mexico's plains and mountains to catwalks from Tokyo to Amsterdam. I've been brought to this back alley in Tenancingo, 2 hours from Mexico City, by one of the country's leading designers, Carla Fernandez. She takes these handmade textiles and manipulates them into something contemporary.
So this is a rebozo.
She unfurls a blue and white fringe shawl, intricately loomed into a tight herringbone pattern nearly 8 feet long.
You can use it as a vest, and then you can turn it, and you will see that it becomes more as a blouse or a sweater. And also, we leave the fringes of the rebozo, so you can actually see that this is all handmade.
You know, what's funny is I think I can probably count the number of stories I've heard about fashion or clothing on NPR on the fingers of one hand.
Yes, and I bet you I did about four of them. We used to never at NPR do stories about fashion. And indeed, if you ask NPR audiences, I know this because I looked at the research, do you care about fashion? 95% of them said no. But if you ask them, do you care about culture? 95% say yes. And I think what has been missing and the reason that people think they don't care about fashion, it's because it's told as a story of very shallow consumerism. If it is told as a story of memento, clothing that is specific to time and place and narrative, it just becomes a much wider and deeper conversation.
Now, your connection to fashion dates back a long way, right? I think, aren't you the daughter of a former runway model?
I'm the daughter of a former department store model. My mother used to model at Gimbel Schuster in Milwaukee back in the 1950s. In fact, I used to model with her.
You did? How old were you?
Three. And I will say I don't specifically remember the modeling, but she was a great seamstress. She taught all three of her daughters to sew. I made all my clothes in high school and a lot of them in college. So the whole notion of making, wearing, significance, and history, for me, that was always a part of the world of clothing.
But so, Jackie, clearly you speak the language of clothing, but you're creating a podcast for the millions of us who do not speak the language of clothing and who are perfectly happy to get up in the morning and pull on the only pair of jeans that are still clean. So what would you, with your public radio editorial sensibility and your deep connection to the language of clothing, what would you want to cover instead?
So, for example, the first piece was 50 years of the Ebony Fashion Fair and how the co-founder of Ebony Magazine, Eunice Johnson, decides that she will go to Milan and Paris and acquire haute couture. She then turned around, took these gowns and items, which she had bought herself on those little gilded chairs over in Paris and Italy, and put it on young African-American men and women. And then she staged hundreds of catwalk shows around the United States. They would do it 10 months out of the year, and they did that for 50 years. The Ebony Fashion Fair started in 1958 in the Grand Ballroom of Chicago's Conrad Hilton Hotel. Then it hit the road, from splashy big city venues to high school gyms and tiny whistle stops. The young models traveled by bus, with seats removed for their long legs, all over the country and throughout the Jim Crow South. Racial tensions were boiling over. A young woman from Vicksburg named Del Handy was with them then.
It almost felt like steam coming up from the pavement. You could just feel it. Our name was on our bus at one time, you know, Ebony Fashion Fair, and I remember them taking the name off the bus so as not to call attention.
Restaurants were off limits. John Johnson, Ebony's publisher, knew the models were aspirational figures, and he wanted them seen that way.
Mr. Johnson had said when we went down south that we could never go in the back door of the restaurant.
Instead, the white bus driver would go get takeout. This is just one story. You know, the other thing that told us we were onto something was the number of museums that are doing fashion shows. Mm-hmm. And this has grown by leaps and bounds. When I say fashion shows, I'm talking about exhibits with fashion at the center, as Ebony was. Ebony started at the Chicago History Museum.
So what about, are there political or economic stories to tell about the seamy side of fashion? Child labor, Korean sweatshops, you know, stories about the production side of the textile and garment industry.
I think that we cannot ignore that. Clearly, that is the underbelly of particularly what is called fast fashion.
What do you mean fast fashion?
So fast fashion is what so many of us acquire today. H&M and Uniqlo are two of the biggest purveyors of fast fashion. Fashion that costs $5, as much as a cup of coffee, maybe less.
You're basically talking about it's the fast food of fashion.
Exactly. And they keep it moving through the stores, and they change the merchandise around a lot. And that kind of cheap, fast fashion, first of all, it winds up in landfills often, you know, within a couple of years. And the human capital, the labor, is often very, very exploitive. So we shop for things that seem like they are good value to us. But what is the source of it?
Jackie, I'm curious, just trying to think ahead. Imagine that the kind of coverage you're talking about happens and becomes a wave, and that we all develop a kind of clothing and fashion literacy. What changes, do you think? What changes about what it's like to get dressed in the morning?
Well, I'm sure that you, Anne, have looked at wonderful pictures from back in the 1940s and 50s and how beautiful people looked. Now take a plane from LA to New York and take a good look around. We have taken the whole notion that our appearance doesn't matter kind of to, you know, a whole level that I think sort of devolves. And it isn't particularly.
You're not somebody who wears sweatpants on airplanes, I take it.
And I don't, as a matter of fact. So I, you know, I'm not saying that there's no room for comfort. Of course there is. But there is a need for style. There's a need for the articulation of the spirit. There is a need to be bold when we're feeling like little mice. There is a need to stand out. These are deep human needs. And it doesn't mean that, you know, you take out your charge card. Fashion's aspirational, but it might also feel exclusive. Mm-hmm. And it isn't. It isn't. There isn't a human body type that can't have a sartorial significance.
Jackie Leiden is the host and founder of The Seams, a new reporting series and podcast about fashion. Of course, fashions change more than just the clothes on our backs. Philosopher Lars Svensson says fashions influence art, music, politics, and yes, even philosophy. He tackles the topic in his treatise, Fashion, a Philosophy. Steve Paulson, who dresses for radio, caught up with him to find out how fashion is significant.
Lars, you call the growth of fashion one of the most decisive events in world history. In fact, you say that you cannot understand the modern world without fashion. You really think fashion is that important?
I think it is. It didn't start out as being that important. I mean, fashion started in the area of clothing in the late Middle Ages, early Renaissance, in which something was seen for the first time in history, seeking novelty for the sake of novelty itself, being new, was a value. It's the first time we see that sort of logic. And then it started to spread into all other areas. So one could say that the logic of fashion, it has turned us all into neophiliacs. We love novelties.
Hmm. Now, does this go back? Does this go back to newness in clothing? I mean, back to the Renaissance. I mean, did this whole craze for novelty begin with people wanting stylish clothing?
Yeah, that's where we see it starting. When people seek change for the sake of change itself. Prior to that, styles had been fairly stable. Basically, the cuts were the same among the rich and the poor. Only the rich, they had better materials, they had more ornamentation often, and so on. But you did not see this whole logic of change for the change itself. That really is not observed until the late Middle Ages, early Renaissance.
So why? I mean, why did people at that point crave change, crave distinctiveness?
It's really hard to say. It might be due to introduction of new secular values, the emergence of capitalism, and then as the bourgeoisie emerged and so on. And of course, also the emergence of the individual, which is this crucial historical figure. I mean, we think it's so obvious to think of ourselves as individuals, but we haven't always done so. And the individual is this character who takes him or herself as a completely unique human being who has to differentiate him or herself from others. This is a huge difference between traditional and non-traditional societies. In traditional societies, you really don't have to ask about who you are. You don't have to ask about the meaning of life because it's already defined for you. But when you start to move on to post-traditional or modern societies, all of this is loosened. The collective does not answer these questions for you anymore. So you have to show who you are as a completely unique individual, and wearing specific clothing and so on becomes a tool in highlighting that identity.
So clothing becomes a form of self-expression. It reveals something about who you are.
Yeah, and of course, that's a fairly common conception that clothing is this brilliant expressive medium. I beg to differ. I think that we are told that fashion is all about individualism, and it's about expressing who you are as a unique individual and so on. But I think that clothing, it's not particularly well-suited medium for expressing yourself. If you have something terribly important to say to the world, say it. Don't wear a specific t-shirt.
But I don't know, it's sort of easier. You don't know, it's just you can walk down the street and people can look at you and, you know, your clothing says something about you, right? Or the image that you want to project to the world.
It says something, but one thing it certainly does not say is who you are as this allegedly unique individual. Say if I were to wear a black suit and black shirt. Doesn't say anything about whether I'm a nice guy or a scumbag. Doesn't say anything on whether I'm to the political left or to the political right. Doesn't really say much about me as an individual. So I would say that whatever fashion is about, it's certainly not about genuine individuality.
And yet, billions of dollars are spent every year on fashion. I mean, this is a huge industry, but you're telling me that, you know, maybe it's kind of overblown here. Maybe, you know, we read more into it than is really there.
Oh, we certainly read a lot more into it. But consumption has become one of our main areas of self-formation. By buying something, we wish to express something to others and to ourselves as well, about who we are. But at the same time, the identity it can provide you with will also be worn out pretty fast. So it really doesn't provide much of a foundation for building a more substantial identity.
Well, I have to confess that I really don't think that much about clothes. As anyone who knows me can tell you, you know, looking at what I wear. But I've heard about this trend called normcore, which, if I understand it, it's very fashion-conscious people wearing very normal clothes. I mean, it could be, you know, L.L. Bean boots or a Land's End sweater, or Levi's jeans, but doing it with intention. In other words, it means something for a 21-year-old in New York with a fancy haircut to wear this kind of stuff.
Yeah, but of course, that's already become a cliche. So if that had some symbolic potential, that you wanted to say something with it, I'd say that that potential has evaporated already. And it tends to do so fast. I mean, when grunge was big, it didn't take very long before you saw grunge outfits on the catwalks. When punk was big, I mean, it took less than a year before you had these fashion spreads in the British magazines about these really cool punk mothers and so on, and others could emulate that style and so on. And then it really loses all its symbolic significance. So that's another thing fashion does really efficiently. It drains all countercultural messages of meaning pretty instantly.
So what have you come out of this whole study of fashion, of sort of constructing a philosophy of fashion, that sort of, you know, have you come to any larger conclusions about what it all means?
Hard to say. I mean, I try to not be too moralistic about fashion. If people enjoy it, I mean, that's fine with me. But I think that it's being presented as something far more important to us than it actually is. On the other hand, it's extremely important because the whole logic there dictates so many things in various social areas. And of course, noticing that logic could perhaps provide us with some resistance towards it, that we do not necessarily have to crave something new simply because something else has gotten old and so on. But apart from that, I really cannot say that the study of fashion provided me with any groundbreaking insights into the meaning of life.
Lars Svensson is a philosopher who teaches at the University of Bergen in Norway. Coming up, can clothing be a force for good? It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and we're talking about fashion in this hour. So even if you don't spend a lot of time thinking or worrying about what you wear, you still can't escape fashion. It's a trillion-dollar global industry that shapes everything, from ideas about beauty to notions of cool. Minha Pham is a professor at the Pratt Institute's Media Studies program, but on the side, she blogs about the fashion industry, and she says clothes can be a powerful lens on global culture. Raymond Tangakar caught up with her.
Minha, there are a lot of people out there that think that fashion is frivolous and it's not really worth serious consideration. I think I actually even read in one of your articles, there was a fashion journalist that said that over-intellectualizing fashion actually sucked the fun out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I take it you don't actually believe that, though. So make the case for us. Why should we be taking fashion seriously?
Well, to an extent, I would say, yes, over-intellectualizing anything sucks the fun out of it. But it's worth thinking about, fashion is worth thinking about, because it's really an avenue into so many different parts of our life and our society, right? So if we're interested in questions of culture and society, the economy, there's a case to be made that understanding fashion leads us to an understanding of how we work as humans, our motivations, our desires, our fantasies, our aspirations.
As we've been researching this show, I've been really struck at all these negative associations that people have. And, you know, at the same time, this is an industry that brings in billions of dollars every year.
That's right.
And it also informs how we present ourselves to the world. So why do you think there's so much hostility to fashion?
I get asked that question a lot, and my answer has often to do with a gender analysis of fashion. Fashion and so many other kinds of culture and practices that are traditionally associated with women and femininity are often seen as frivolous, right? So it's not just fashion, but also soap operas, for example, that are seen as frivolous and just not that important. So I think that that kind of hostility towards fashion and that dismissal of fashion is linked to a larger, a broader sexism in our culture that lingers.
I also wonder if an aversion to fashion is somehow related maybe to a certain amount of privilege, right? Because fashion is about self-expression, but at the same time, it's also about managing the perceptions that others have of you. When I'm buying a new shirt, this is what goes through my head. I'll think about whether it looks good, whether it's cheap, how it fits me. But there's this secondary thought that goes through my head, whether it makes me look more Asian, for example, or even if it makes me look like I'm trying to appear white.
Whatever that means, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so perhaps if you're averse to fashion, maybe you're in a position of luxury where you don't always have to think about what others think of you, or at least think about it excessively.
I see what you're saying. I think the idea that maybe white men don't have to worry about their appearance because their appearance, there's already kind of a taken-for-granted assumption that they are respectable, that they are legitimate, that they should be respected, right? And that people of color and other marginalized people don't have that privilege. And so that the attention to their appearance is often about survival in some way, about countering the negative perceptions that are often imposed on them. So I think that's true. But I also don't think that it's just white men or white straight men that view fashion as frivolous, right? That I think that this is actually not located in one group, but is part of a cultural and national sentiment that has more to do with the ways in which feminine activities and feminine cultures are devalued.
And you have a number of articles that also address the role of race in fashion and the fashion industry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as we've heard, there have been discussions about the fashion industry's lack of diversity. And there's an article you wrote in which you talk about what you termed multicultural scenery.
Yeah.
Could you tell us what that means?
So in that article, I'm thinking about the ways in which we see people of color in fashion media, so that they mostly appear in fashion ads, for example, as a background, as a backdrop that suggests something about the brand's progressive, urban outlook. So people of color then, in these ads that I'm talking about, are props, right, that tell us nothing about the people themselves, but rather about the brand's kind of interest in or attention to diversity. When we see people of color as multicultural scenery, what that actually does is it re-centralizes the whiteness in fashion, because these people are there to support oftentimes the white models in the fashion images. They provide the frame around which whiteness is made central again.
And so what would it take to, I suppose, upend that and make whiteness not the central element of fashion?
Oh, it would take a lot more than a fashion ad. It would take a structural change. And that's one of the problems I think that the fashion industry has with diversity, is that there's just a general lack of understanding of what racial diversity really would mean. Mm-hmm. So that oftentimes the fashion media, fashion modeling agents, fashion designers, for example, attend to a number count, a body count. How many models of color are on the runway? How many models of color are in this ad? How many models of color are representing this brand as a spokesperson? in order to actually make real change, you would have to institute change in terms of, you know, who are the editors of major fashion magazines? Who are the directors of modeling agencies? How do we think about the beautiful body or the fashionable body in ways that are outside of the dominant images that we see of thin to the point of anorexic, thin, long-limbed, young white women, right? How do we think about beauty and fashion in larger ways so that the idea of being fashionable doesn't mean that unless you, you know, unless you fit a very narrow set of criteria, you're not beautiful, you're not fashionable.
Hmm. You're saying that it requires challenging our conceptions of beauty and actually including non-dominant bodies, races. But how do you do that on like a societal level though?
Well, I think that work has already started. Now we have blogs, for example, that are celebrating and focusing on the very kinds of bodies that you almost never see in fashion magazines. And if you do, then oftentimes as a prop or as a background piece, so that you have blogs devoted to larger women, you have blogs devoted to celebrating the bodies of disabled women. We see Asian bloggers all over the internet. We see a diversity of different bodies enjoying, celebrating, participating in fashion. So I think creating more so that kind of standard, that ideal is actually just one among many ways of being beautiful or fashionable, mm-hmm. will start to shift our ideas of what beauty and fashion can look like.
So it sounds like you're saying that fashion serves as a really wonderful lens through which to view culture. I'm also wondering if it could be like an agent of social change.
I think it absolutely can be, and it has. Many marginalized communities historically and now continue to use fashion and fashion their bodies through clothes and accessories in ways that change the perception that others have about them. One of the ways that I talk about it with my students is to think about the politics of aesthetics. That aesthetics, the site of aesthetics, whether we're talking about fashion or hairstyle, has always been about a struggle over the meanings of Asianness, of blackness, of womanness. And so, you know, think about the Black is Beautiful movement and how the idea of styling black hair in a particular way, for example, or black clothes in a particular way, created a movement around the idea that black bodies should be valued.
Minha Pham teaches media studies at the Pratt Institute and also blogs about fashion. She's got a new book due out later this year called Asians Wear Clothes on the Internet: Race, Gender, and the Work of Personal Style Blogging. Back in 2013, more than 1,000 people died when a building collapsed in Dhaka, Bangladesh. Rana Plaza housed at least 5 garment factories. The people there were earning low wages, making cheap clothing for Western fashion chains. After the collapse, the global garment industry came under scrutiny for the human cost of so-called fast fashion. And that's a trend that swept malls and main streets, where clothing stores keep people perpetually shopping by offering new styles every couple weeks. Now, an alternative might be arising. Here's Sarah Nix talking with Elizabeth Klein about fashion, fast and slow.
So a couple years back, I went to a Kmart and bought a pair of $7 black canvas slip-on shoes. And they were so cheap that they just wore out immediately. I think I wore them out in a couple weeks. So I went back to the store and bought the store out of my size. I bought 7 pairs of $7 shoes. And that for me was kind of a wake-up call. But I had been thinking about my closet and my shopping habits for a while, because I, like a lot of people, I attempt to be a conscious consumer. You know, I recycle, I ride my bike when I can, I take public transportation, I try to buy organic food. But then when I would look in my closet, there was absolutely no reflection or thought. I had no idea where my clothes came from, who made them, how they were made. And on top of it, I just had a lot of them. And I had a lot of stuff that I wasn't wearing. I had somehow over the years developed this very transient disposable attitude towards clothing. And that's really what set me on the path to kind of find out how cheap fast fashion had taken over not only my closet, but the closets of every single person that I knew.
And so on that journey, you went to Bangladesh, you went to China, you visited places where these fast fashions are being made. What did you see?
I think two of the most astonishing things I learned on my trip to China and Bangladesh was, first of all, the scale of the global garment industry. In Bangladesh alone, which is one very popular spot for producing clothing now, there's more than 5 million garment workers. In China alone, I'm pretty sure there's over 10 million garment workers. So
wow.
There was this one area in southern China where on either side of the highway, I could see thousands and thousands and thousands of factories. They stretched as far as the eye could see. And the factories were enshrouded in this cloud of pollution. So there are entire cities, districts, tens of millions of people in southern China who are churning out all these consumer goods at an enormous cost to the environment. And it's completely hidden from view from American consumers.
And there has been over the past 10 years this growing demand for ethically produced products, environmentally responsible products. You talked about organic food. How have fashion retailers addressed that demand?
I think that there's been a pretty dramatic growth in the ethical fashion movement or the slow fashion movement. Even since Overdress was released, the hardcover came out in 2012 and the paperback came out in 2013. And I remember when I finished the book feeling kind of frustrated at the lack of alternatives. And since then, there's been a lot of movement toward rethinking and improving the way the global fashion industry runs. And a lot of that had to do with the collapse of Rana Plaza in Bangladesh in 2013, when over 1,000 garment workers lost their lives. I think for a lot of consumers, that was a real wake-up call and a turning point. And I think the other part of it was a reaction to the recession. You had a lot of people kind of looking around and saying, okay, I don't have a lot of money. What can I live without? We've all been on this sort of nationwide shopping binge. Is there a better way to get dressed? So I've seen a lot of new ethical fashion retailers, fashion designers, and even the fast fashion chains are coming out with ethical alternatives to their products as well.
So I've also heard these stories about sweatshops and toxic dyes, and I try
right.
to be a careful shopper. Also, I am on a public radio salary, which means I don't have a lot of money to spend.
Right.
I love beautiful garments, but particularly not living in a big city, it feels like there's no option for me.
Yeah, that's part of the problem that I describe in Overdressed is in the era of fast fashion, we've chased the alternatives out of the market. But I think what's happening now is you have a lot of ethical retailers that are opening up online. I think the slow fashion movement is probably 15 years behind the food movement. So hopefully down the road, we'll have, you know, a Whole Foods or Trader Joe's of fashion.
So it sounds like you think that Americans are a little more willing to pay more for clothes than they were 5 years ago?
Yeah, I think Americans, I think they're very savvy shoppers in the sense that they want value. They're not going to pay more for something if it's not worth more. But if something is made in the U.S., it's made ethically and it's made out of good materials and it has a good story associated with it, they'll absolutely pay more for it. And then a couple years ago, or maybe it was just last year, this fashion trend emerged called normcore, where it was just this complete rejection of fashion where people were just like, you know what, I'm just going to wear like acid wash jeans from the 90s and like a plain t-shirt and sneakers, and I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm not going to follow the trends anymore, which I thought was really, really funny and also part of the backlash that's happening against fast fashion.
You know, over the course of this hour, we've been talking about how it's not uncommon for people to dismiss fashion as frivolous and something not worthy of consideration. And I think in your book, you make a good case for, listen, it has enormous environmental and economic consequences for us. It's a huge industry. But I also wonder if that kind of dismissal of fashion is a roadblock to actually getting people to pay closer attention to where their clothes are coming from.
Yeah, I think that the fact that clothing is so cheap now is part of the reason why it's considered to be frivolous. And the reality is it's a trillion-dollar global industry. And Americans especially spend an enormous amount of time shopping and consuming clothing. And I think that one of the things that is so joyous and fulfilling about the slow fashion movement, it just adds to the experience of getting dressed. If you know the story behind what you're wearing, who made it, how it was made, and trying to convey that to a wider population, it's been sort of a roadblock, but I think that roadblock also existed in the food movement. And then basically what we needed was somebody like Michael Pollan from Omnivore's Dilemma to come along and say, you know what, there's actually a much more fulfilling, enriching way to think about food.
What you're saying reminds me of a dress that was handed down to me from a friend, and she had had it handed down to her from her husband's mother. And it's this beautiful chiffon floral 1920s dress. And it is a precious object for me because I know the story and because I can see the quality. Maybe that's what slow fashion is, having those objects, those garments, be precious.
Absolutely. I think that the connection that you're describing there is something that's been lost. But I feel like even, you know, somebody that who's almost their entire closet is full of cheap clothes, they probably have that one thing like you're describing that, you know, they inherited from someone or was handed down to them or they wore to a special occasion that they're never going to throw away. They do have that feeling about something in their closet. And imagine if that's the way you felt about everything you owned.
Elizabeth Klein's book about fast fashion and its alternatives is called Overdressed. She talked with Sarah Nix. If you're curious about how to get your hands on responsible fashions, visit our website, ttbook.org, for a list of suggestions. Coming up, Vietnamese-born writer Quan Barry talks about her debut novel, She Weeps Each Time You're Born. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
My name is Edward Hirsch. I'm a poet. My two most recent books are Gabriel, a Poem, which is a book-length elegy for my son, and A Poet's Glossary, which is a compendium of poetic terms. The book I'd like to recommend is a book called Memorial by the English poet Alice Oswald. And she calls it a version of Homer's Iliad. And what Oswald has done is she's taken the Iliad and she's stripped it of its narrative. She lists all of the boys and men, young men mostly, who've died at the beginning of her book. And there are four or five pages of these. And then what she does is dramatize the deaths of each of these figures. And she balances this with famous Homeric similes. I'll give you a sample. The way the book begins is, the first to die was Protesilaus, a focused man who hurried to darkness with 40 black ships leaving the land behind. Men sailed with him from those flower-lit cliffs where the grass gives growth to everything. Parassus, Iton, Petlaeus, Antron. He died in mid-air, jumping to be first ashore. There was his house half-built. His wife rushed out, clawing her face. Podarchus, his altogether less impressive brother, took over command, but that was long ago. He's been in the Black Earth now for thousands of years. And that's how the book proceeds. It just moves from figure to figure, and you begin to understand the Iliad as a great anti-war poem, and that by taking away the narrative, by taking away the battles, by taking away what's happened and just listing the figures who died and saying how they died, you get this communal elegy that gives you a sense of the devastations of war. And each of these figures comes alive for one moment for us. And the poem becomes, the Iliad becomes, a vast memorial. Her name is Alice Oswald, and she's, in this book, given us a kind of reckless adaptation of the Iliad. And I think the book is a lyrical masterpiece of lamentation. Now, when you read the Iliad as a whole, the losses are just part of the larger story. But when you read Oswald's version of Homer's Iliad, then what you're getting in this extraction is just the cost, just the people who died, just the dramatization of them and what it felt like. And it creates a tremendous communal portrait of boys at war, really boys dying at war.
Edward Hirsch recommends Memorial, a version of Homer's Iliad by Alice Oswald. You'll find more bookmarks plus an interview with Hirsch on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This weekend marks the 50th anniversary of the first U.S. combat troops landing in Vietnam, and April will see another historic date, the 40th anniversary of the fall of Saigon, or Black April, as it's known to many Vietnamese refugees. Now, in this country, we tend to view Vietnam almost exclusively through the lens of our war there. So here's something different, a magical, realist novel set in Vietnam from the poet Quan Barry. It's called She Weeps Before You're Born. And it's the story of a little girl who can hear ghosts. Her name is Rabbit. She was born at the height of the Vietnam War on the night of a full moon in her mother's grave.
On this, we do not agree. Some of us say she was made manifest in a muddy ditch on the way to the pineapple plantation. Others say it happened hunkered down in a piggery, the little ones with their wet snouts full of wonder at the strange, bristleless being wriggling among them for milk. Either way, we bow to you. Believe us when we say life is a wheel. There was no beginning. There is no end. But we will tell you the story as she believes it occurred, under the full rabbit moon, 6 feet below ground in a wooden box, her mother's hands cold as ice, overhead, the bats of good fortune flitting through the dark.
Quan, this is your character, Rabbit, who has an origin story that is so gorgeous. She's a magical baby from the very beginning, born literally in a grave.
Yes. So this is a story that I've been obsessed with for many years. It's actually a story from Vietnamese folktales. So there's the story of the mother of a baby born in a grave. And I had heard this story, I read of it maybe more than a decade ago. So again, the story has sort of been ruminating in my mind for a long time.
Rabbit could speak to the dead or hear the dead. What exactly is her relationship with the dead? What do they want from her?
Yeah, they want to be acknowledged. They want to be heard. They want their stories to be heard. The dead tell her things and she simply says, I hear you, and that's enough for them. In the beginning, the words were all in her head, along with the memories of sulfurous clouds and leaf notes, bats blessing her with their leathery wings. Perhaps we are the reason she didn't utter a single word for so long. The truth is, during those first years of total silence, people hardly noticed. Why talk to the living when she had us? And if they had noticed her lack of speech, if they had wondered, what would they have seen? The way at dusk this baby girl would sometimes look at empty air, nothing there at all, and begin to weep. To back up a little bit, just to tell you where the whole idea sort of came from, I was back in Vietnam in 2010, just sort of rumbling around the country with some people I had toured with before, these Vietnamese guides. And we stopped at this one particular memorial, and there was a small house next to it and a caretaker. And we knocked on the door, and the caretaker invited us in. And this caretaker was very excited because a woman named Phan Thi Bit Hang was going to be visiting the memorial. And of course, I had to ask, who is Phan Thi Bit Hang? And it turns out that she is Vietnam's official psychic, that her story is when she was a child, she was bitten by a rabid dog. And when she came out of her coma, she can now hear the voices of the dead. And so she's the psychic the Vietnamese government actually uses when they need to find the remains of soldiers, when they need to find the remains of important historical figures.
Can she find remains and mass graves?
Yeah, I guess she has. And so Rabbit is just sort of based on that idea. It's not based on her, but this idea of somebody, particularly in a country like Vietnam, where obviously there are so many people who've gone missing and so many people, 3 million civilians who were killed during the American war there. It's a Buddhist country where ancestor worship is really important. So it's important for people to be able to communicate with their lost ones, even if they don't have their remains.
Now, you told NPR Scott Simon recently in an interview I heard that you think of Rabbit as the spirit of Vietnam itself.
I do. Because she can hear the voices of the dead, she can hear the history of the country, going all the way back to the French colonialization in the 1800s.
The rubber plantations during World War II, that's a setting for part of it.
Because oftentimes when Americans think about Vietnam, you know, we only think about roughly 63 to 75, the American involvement there. We think of Apocalypse Now. You know, we think of these movies and that's it. And it's the idea that, you know, Vietnam has been around for a very long time and has a very rich history. So in many ways, I wasn't interested in thinking about the American war in this book. I was interested in thinking about everything else.
You've traveled in Vietnam quite a bit, and this is personal for you. You were born in Vietnam, right?
I was. I was born there in 73, and I left in 74. So I have no memories of Vietnam in the 70s of any kind.
Uh-huh. You were adopted here. You left your whatever parents you had in Vietnam.
Yes.
Yeah. What was it like the first time you went back?
I've been fortunate to travel to a lot of places. So honestly, for me, it was sort of another landscape. It doesn't necessarily have any more pull for me than any other country does.
How come?
I think because growing up, honestly, I don't necessarily feel particularly Vietnamese. I don't actually look particularly Vietnamese. I am Vietnamese. I'm not trying to distance myself from that, but it's not necessarily part of an everyday part of my life. I've been there 4 times and I'm compelled by it, but it's not, like I said, it's not, I don't feel like a homecoming kind of experience when I go there. Like one side of a hill with you at the foot. From here, everything rises. The worn path, the moon with its long bright ears. Imagine water traveling back up into the sky. The sound of it climbing like a question. Ma? Who would I be if I had stayed?
You said Vietnam is a country with a very rich ghost story tradition. How are they different from the ones people tell in the West?
In my mind, they tend to be more poetic, and the ghost stories in the West tend to be more trying to scare you. And
played for horror.
Yeah, exactly. And Asian ghost stories oftentimes aren't like that. They're just more, like, you know right from the outset that somebody's dead, whereas in a Western ghost story, you find out at the end, and there was a hook on the car door or something like that, you know?
Well, in the West, I think there's something horrifying about being dead, whereas I'm wondering, in a Buddhist culture, maybe the concept of a spirit isn't so scary.
I think that's true because, again, the idea of the spirits in general are much more present with certain Asian cultures. The idea that in your house you would have an altar, you know, oftentimes you make sure that, you know, the rice bowl is full, there are photographs of people. So the idea that the spirits are with us, the spirits never, you know, we ourselves will become spirits, we will become back. So I think that probably ties into it a great deal.
How then do all the deaths from war, atrocity, displacement, how does that play out in a country like Vietnam with a very strong ghost story tradition and acceptance of spirits? Does a culture like that deal with, feel about all those deaths differently than we might in the West, do you think?
Hmm. I'm not sure, but I did hear a story on NPR many years ago about sort of the cottage industry of psychics in general that have sprung up in Vietnam. You know, there were stories of people, again, who want to find remains of loved ones, if that's not possible, want to at least know what happened, want to communicate with them. And that, so as I mentioned earlier, Phan Thi Bit Hang is the official psychic of Vietnam, but my understanding is that there's many, many, many others.
I'm just thinking about how there are some landscapes that can feel haunted. You know, I'm thinking of Gettysburg in this country.
Yeah, I was just thinking of Normandy and things like that. So I feel like that's a very, I feel like the way the West deals with it is very different, yeah, because it's like this, it's a specific place, you know, like, okay, we've set up all these crosses and we've done all this work and that's like the one, as opposed to the entire landscape.
Mm-hmm.
It feels much more contained maybe in the West, whereas in Vietnam it does feel more like it's sort of part of life. Like in the West, again, we tend to sort of cordon off our grief. Like, you know, we relegate it to certain days or to certain occasions or what have you. Whereas, like I said, in Vietnam, it feels a little more all-pervasive.
You've written about Vietnam and landscapes of grief, not just in this new novel, but in previous volumes of poetry. And there was one poem I thought maybe we could end with, because the last line is the same as the title of this book.
Okay, great. So the title of this poem is called Quan Am, and Quan Am is the Bodhisattva of compassion. All throughout Asia, she has different names, but in Vietnam, they call her Quan Am. And one other thing I should say about Quan Am is that in Chinatown, specifically in Saigon, you can see there's a lot of statues of her in general all throughout Vietnam, but particularly in Chinatown. A lot of the boat people who left in the late 1970s were ethnically Chinese. And it's believed that she helped them on their journeys over the water and across the sea. Quan Am. And on the third night, the Gulf was seething like a fire, and the boats were leaking heavily. And they knew it was another end. And the way they were put to sea, forced to leave everything, and the government cared nothing because it could. And then she saw them, the Lady of a Thousand Eyes, burn, burn, and simply the water was made as glass. And she is the way when there is no way. She weeps each time you're birthed.
Quan Barry's new novel is called She Weeps Each Time You're Born. You know, every week, to the best of our knowledge, brings you interviews with writers and artists, people making and shaping our culture. It's kind of like a weekly dinner party with an amazing guest list, and you're invited. Subscribe to the weekly podcast and stock up on some great conversations. You can find us on iTunes or Stitcher. Just search for To the Best of Our Knowledge. This program comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin, and this hour was produced by Sarah Nix and Raymond Tungekar, with help from Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, and Craig Ely. Steve Mullen at Walk West Music wrote our theme music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.